Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. today. I'm Todd Wilkin. Rod Dreher joins us for the first 25 minutes of this hour. We'll be talking to him about the religion gap. Okay, the conversation will involve some discussion of media bias, but that's no story. For heaven's sakes, everybody is aware to one degree or another that there's bias in the media. I think what frustrates most people is the unwillingness to admit to bias. I've got biases all over the place, but I try to the best of my ability to admit to my biases. I don't always do it so well, but I try to the best of my ability. Of course, I am not bound by a journalist's code. I'm just purely editorial. And so I guess I'm allowed to have them and admit to them. We'll talk about media bias, but it goes beyond that. It also has to do with a religion gap, a gap greater than the gender gap, greater than any kind of income gap. It is a gap in American social life and politics that may go a long ways toward explaining a lot of the differences we see between, say, for instance, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. Rod Dreher is editorial writer for the Dallas Morning News. He's author of the cover story of a recent issue of Touchstone Magazine titled The Godless Party. If you'd like to join us, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727 are our numbers. Rod, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good to be here, Todd.
How do you like your new job at the Dallas Morning News?
Well, I'll tell you, it's a lot different from National Review, which is where I was last time we spoke. We moved down to Dallas, my wife and I did, because we wanted a more family-friendly and, frankly, a more religious place in which to raise our family and have more kids. And in that regard, it's been great. But I tell you, it's interesting to go back to the sort of combat I knew, ideological combat and good-natured combat I knew in previous newsrooms where I was the only conservative.
Well, we'll talk about that in the course of this conversation. I need to tell you, I am a Dallas native, born and bred in Dallas. Love the city. Best variety of restaurants anywhere. And I actually read the Dallas Morning News every single day, online, every single day.
About to start a blog. Your listeners who may have liked The Corner, National Review's blog, they'll be able to read me on the Dallas Morning News blog, which will start in a couple of weeks.
Let me recommend Spring Creek Barbecue, and I'm trying to think of some other great places to eat down there since you're new to the area. Beware of, just because it's a Tex-Mex restaurant, beware. Some are good and some are not.
Oh, look, my wife, she grew up on that stuff, and we have to go there at least twice a week.
Oh, really?
El Phoenix, baby.
El Phoenix. Okay, now you're bringing back memories. El Phoenix. It used to be the only Mexican food place in town, and now, of course, you can't mow your grass without running into a Mexican food place down in Dallas. Enough of nostalgia for the old home place. You say that that according to people in the news business, reasonable, intelligent, sociable, religious conservatives don't exist or simply are not supposed to exist. What do you mean by that?
They're not supposed to exist because nobody in most newsrooms knows anybody who is a religious conservative and is also a decent person. That's why, as a religious conservative, I've often found in my previous jobs, my colleagues can't quite believe that they're dealing with somebody they could actually be friends with who holds the sort of views that I hold. And they're not aware, in most cases, of their own bias.
Now, you also point out in your article that by and large, journalists view religious people in political terms. Explain what you mean by that.
I can give you an example from when I used to work in New York at the New York Post. I proposed a column once to the city editor and about something to do with evangelicals, I forget what, and he turned it down. He said, "You don't understand. This is not a religious town." Well, he didn't understand that in his own neighborhood, which was my neighborhood, there were Catholic churches, evangelical churches, mainline Protestant churches, mosques, synagogues. He just never saw these places because he never went to them and didn't know anybody who did. The only way he understood religion was as it related to politics. In New York City, that basically means the Catholic Church and the Jewish vote. And I think more broadly in America, people in newsrooms tend to understand the phenomenon of religion in terms they can understand, which is politics. And it also happens to be the place where they feel most threatened, where they look at religious conservatives and see that we vote pro-life, we vote for pro-family candidates, and that worries them. And so they see us naturally as a threat.
What picture of religious types do they get by viewing religious types in purely political terms? What's the skewed picture here?
Well, the skewed picture is they see us as a threat to all that is decent. They see how we vote, and again, as I said, we vote pro-life, and they see that as meaning that we are in favor of shutting down a woman's right to choose. I mean, they tend to have the most outrageous stereotypes of religious conservatives. They don't see that religious conservatives are often the ones down there working with the poor in this country and overseas to try to alleviate their suffering. No, it's all about Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, who want to go into the schools, throw out evolution, and so on and so forth. It's just a cartoon. Unfortunately, this cartoon version of religious conservatives is what guides news coverage, and because it guides news coverage, it tends to inform the rest of America as to who religious conservatives are. And I think in the end, it tells the rest of America that religious conservatives are a danger to our pluralist democracy and that they should be denied a place at the table.
Now, I'm wondering whether or not it is pan-religious or whether or not it is in particular Christians, because it seems to me that if there is an anti-religious bias in the news media, it is not so much pointed towards, say, your average law-abiding and rather socially conservative Muslim or Buddhist or Hindu.
Gosh, no, no. Are you kidding with Muslims? I mean, it seems that Muslims can do no wrong as far as a lot of editors are concerned. And believe me, I have personal experience with that, too, in New York. If they treated Muslim leaders, if media editors and producers treated Muslim leaders and the Muslim religion with the same level of scrutiny they gave to the Christian religion, there would be a lot more critical coverage of Islam in this country. Now, it is only a Christian thing, and I think it's mostly the fault of A, prejudice against Christians, B, the lack of Christians in newsrooms, and C, the lack of curiosity as to what Christians are really all about and the differences among Christians and the nuances there. I mean, you think that, you said earlier, Todd, when you started out the program, that you are not bound by a journalist's code because you're not a journalist. Well, journalists can't be completely objective. That's not possible. But they can at least be fair. And journalists are supposed to be curious about the world around them and not only see what confirms and conforms to their own stereotypes. And that's what we're not seeing in this country.
The bias also seems to be unevenly applied even among Christians. And by that, I mean, there are people who profess to be Christians, and I don't know if they are or not, but for the sake of argument, we say people who profess to be Christians who are pro-choice, who are in favor of some of the favorite issues of the media. And they are not singled out as people who should not deserve a place at the table. In fact, they're often welcomed to the table.
Oh, you're right. You're right about that. In fact, one of my favorite examples is Francis Kissling, the longtime head of this group called Catholics for Free Choice, a pro-abortion group. She opposes Catholic teaching, and the bishops have condemned her and have said she does not speak for the Catholic Church. But who turns up on the evening news and on Crossfire and places like that time and time again to speak, to give the other side of what Catholics think? Francis Kissling. And recently in Massachusetts, you had a Jesuit professor at a Boston college testifying in favor of gay marriage before the Massachusetts legislature. That's an outrage. But these are the kind of Christians, quote-unquote Christians, that the media go to whenever they want to comment, like Richard McBrien, the Catholic theologian at Notre Dame, because he's going to give the reliably liberal interpretation every single time.
There are a few, and it seems as though it's a love-hate relationship, especially with regard to broadcast media, in particular television and cable, that you will find, when you get your panel together, you will find, say, Dr. Albert Mohler there, who is not Jerry Falwell. He's a very reasonable man and a very decent guest on this program, too. You'll find him there, but he will usually be surrounded by Rabbi Shmuley Boteach and just blazingly liberal theologians of other stripes.
Yeah, you know, I think part of it, too, Todd, and this is something I have trouble trying to convey to Christian audiences when I go talk about media bias, is a lot of it has to do with sheer laziness. You find these people like Richard McBrien, the liberal Catholic, and maybe some of the more liberal Protestants. They're the ones that reporters have in their Rolodexes. A lot of religious conservatives feel like it's a lost cause anyway with the media, and so they don't reach out to the media to try to convince individual reporters and producers to give them a call and say, look, you know, I represent a lot of believers. I represent a legitimate perspective. You should call me sometime. And, of course, Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, folks like that have long had their phone numbers in the Rolodexes of producers and editors. And those producers and editors call on them, even though we've seen that Reverend Falwell and Reverend Robertson have had a significant drop-off in support and political influence. It's easy for reporters to call them, so they do.
Now, give us a brief description of, and then a history of the religion gap, especially as it pertains to the political parties in the United States.
Well, what my article for Touchstone talked about was a study done by Baruch College professors, Louis Bolte, Gerald DeMaio. They contended, and these aren't religious people at all, they contended that over the past generation, a religion gap has gone up in American politics. And everybody in the American media knows or thinks they know the story about how the religious right rose to prominence in American politics, and particularly within the Republican Party. What people don't realize is that militant secularist, anti-religious folks have risen to prominence in the same way and perhaps even more ruthlessly within the Democratic Party. They say, and this is news to me, I had no idea this was the case, they say the watershed event in terms of this happening was a 1972 Democratic convention at which secularists seized control of the party and nominated George McGovern. Now, before then, neither party had many secularists among its delegates. But they did a survey of the Democratic delegates that year and found that the Democratic Party was badly split between the religious and moral traditionalists on one side and the secularists on the other. Well, the secularists won, and they were helped mightily by the next year by the 1973 Supreme Court decision legalizing abortion. And thus began the long march of the so-called Reagan Democrats out of the Democratic Party. They found that by 1992, 20%, only 20% of the Democratic Convention delegates went to religious services even once a month, while over 60% of Republican delegates did. You know, so by then, you can already see over the 70s, particularly in the 1980s, religious conservatives found a home in the Republican Party. Now, that was primarily because they found that the secularists who ran the Democratic Party refused to make room for religious conservatives.
So what does the gap look like today? How would you characterize it?
Well, it's growing. Bolte and DeMaio found that the religious gap, and I'm quoting from their study, the religious gap among white voters, and this is primarily a white phenomenon because black religious conservatives and Hispanics tend to vote pretty reliably with the Democrats. Anyway, the religious gap among white voters in the 1992, 96, and 2000 presidential elections was more important than any other demographic and social cleavages in the electorate. That is to say, it's a bigger split than gender, than differences in education, income, occupation, whatever. This is an enormous gap, and it's getting wider as I think the Democratic Party is becoming more and more intolerant. It's certainly the late Bob Casey could tell you, the guy that governor of Pennsylvania, pro-life Democrat all his life, pro-labor. They wouldn't even let him speak because he wanted to voice a pro-life sentiment. And anyway, it's getting wider and wider, but the media are still not looking at it. The numbers that these professors came up with for how the New York Times and the Washington Post, which drive most American media coverage, even TV media, they're not even looking at this. And in fact, the professors found, and I'm going to read from their study again, this is one thing that really shocked me, quote, one has to reach back to pre-New Deal America when political divisions between Catholics and Protestants encapsulated local ethno-cultural cleavages over prohibition, immigration, public education, and blue laws to find a period when voting behavior was influenced by this degree of antipathy toward a religious group. In other words, if Al Smith, the Catholic presidential candidate, were to come back and run for president today, his enemies wouldn't be the anti-Catholic bigots from the Bible Belt, but today's urbane anti-Christian bigots of the coastal cities, like New York, San Francisco, L.A.
We're talking with Rod Dreher, editorial writer for, I imagine he will be editor there someday, but editorial writer for the Dallas Morning News and author of a cover story in a recent issue of Touchstone magazine titled The Godless Party. We're talking about the religious gap. Rod, how much does the opinion of various news editors, newsroom opinion, how much does it have to do with the gap in the coverage of the influence of religious antipathy in politics?
Todd, I think it has everything to do with it, because if you don't see something as an issue or a problem or a phenomenon, you're not going to assign reporters to take a look at it. 80%, there was a study done about 10 years ago. I don't know what the numbers are now, but 10 years ago, Bob Lichter, the Washington guy who runs a Washington polling organization, found that 80% of newsroom editors and reporters polled said they were Democrats and that they didn't go to church. Well, for these people, the secularist position is normative. This is normal. This is how normal people are. And people who go to church, people who vote their moral convictions, who have traditional Christian moral convictions, they're the weirdos. And if that's how you see the world, and more importantly, if no one around you challenges you on that, even in a friendly way, then inevitably that's how your coverage and your newspaper or your TV station is going to come out. I had to go this summer up to New York to speak to some Christian journalism students at the World Journalism Institute, run by World Magazine. And I said, look, we need people like you in newsrooms. We need people in there who can challenge the dominant paradigm, which is for militant secularism, and just bring more balanced coverage to the newsrooms and to newspapers. I wouldn't want to live in a world where all the coverage reflected only my worldview, because I would be missing something important. But that's not how things are seen by most editors and reporters, I would say.
There was an attempt made in the 2000 presidential elections, early in the elections, by then presidential candidate Al Gore, to win God back for the Democratic Party. He had some rather public statements that didn't amount to much, saying, look, God is not a wholly owned subsidiary of the Republican Party, things like that. What became of it?
I don't think he got very far, to be quite honest. I mean, I had completely forgotten about it until you brought it up. But I mean, he did say that, but there just wasn't a lot of comment on it, because I think the people for whom religion really matters and directs their lives and their choices tend to be religious conservatives. But you do raise a good point there. Touchstone magazine, after it ran this story of mine, it got a lot of angry mail from readers saying, you people have called the Republican Party by default the godly party. If the Democrats are godless, then the Republicans are godly in your view, and I don't agree with it. Cancel my subscription. Well, that's not true. The Republican Party, as Touchstone editor Steve Hutchins wrote later, so the Republican Party is not particularly favored by Touchstone editors, and as soon as it starts, should it start to abandon Christian moral principles, Touchstone would turn on it too. The fact of the matter is, though, it's the Democrats that believe in abortion and legal abortion. It's the Democrats who keep pushing anti-family legislation, not the Republicans. The Democrats have run people who believe in traditional Christianity and traditional Judaism, for that matter, out of their party and into the arms of the Republicans. And it's to call the Democrats a godless party is not the same thing as saying that the Republicans are godly.
Is there another attempt here? I'm looking at this wide field of 9 Democratic hopefuls for the presidential candidacy coming up in 2004. And there are some ostensibly religious people in that field of candidates. You've got Al Sharpton, who is a reverend of some kind. You've got Joe Lieberman, who sometimes he's Orthodox, sometimes he's conservative, sometimes he's Reform. You never know, depending on the day. But he is very openly Jewish. And then you have the likes of Representative Dick Gephardt, who still claims to be, I think, Baptist, something along those lines. Will they have to, for the sake of ascending to the ladder of their party, kowtow to the anti-religious secularists?
Of course they will. And they're doing it already. All they have to do is say they're pro-choice. And they'll get up there and thunder about protecting a woman's sacred right to choose. And that'll do it. I think one interesting thing, Todd, and I'm not sure how the Republicans are going to handle this either, will be the gay marriage issue. The Supreme Court decision in Lawrence opened the door for gay marriage, and I don't think any politician in this country, any national politician, wants to touch this issue, but I don't think they're going to be able to avoid it at all. And it's going to be interesting to see how these Democrats handle it, because if they come out against it, and most of them, I believe, are on record, except for Al Sharpton, are on record as being against it, then they're going to anger a significant number of the militant secularists in their party. But if they come out in favor of it, I think you're going to see a lot of minority voters think twice about voting Democratic, and certainly a lot of labor voters.
With about a minute and a half before we have to go, Rod, You've mentioned it several times already, but make your case for the desperate need for Christians in the newsroom.
I see it every day here and in every newsroom in which I've worked. There simply are not people there who share a small, orthodox, traditional view of Christianity. And newsrooms are missing stories that need to be reported, stories that only people who are religious believers see. Right here in my own newsroom, we have a policy where they want us to go out to the mosque to get to know the imams at the mosque. I said, that's a great idea. When are we going to have the bus trip out to the evangelical megachurches? You can't understand Dallas without understanding the evangelical megachurches. People here tend not to see that just because they don't know anybody who goes to them. That's why we need Christians in the newsroom to make our newspapers better.
Rod, we're going to be going down to Dallas the week of July the 28th. And possibly we're hoping to broadcast down there a day at a Confessional Lutheran Youth Conference. If you have an opportunity, we're actually going to be in Arlington for the conference. If you have an opportunity, we'd like to take you out for a meal while we're down there later this month and show you a bit of the Dallas cuisine.
That would be terrific. I look forward to it, Todd.
All right. For those of you who want to read the editorials of Rod Dreher in the Dallas Morning News, the website for the Dallas Morning News is dallasnews.com. That's dallasnews.com. Rod Dreher, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Always a pleasure.
Rod Dreher is an editorial writer for the Dallas Morning News and author of the cover story of a recent issue of Touchstone Magazine titled The Godless Party. When we come back from this break, we've got open lines for your questions and your comments. I want to pick up on something. Where am I going to pick up here? I got to get my pile over here. Oh, I know where I'm going to pick up on. Justice Scalia. Apparently, he has been taken to the woodshed by just about everybody, and he is speaking out a bit. USA Today, he's saying that the Supreme Court has made a major error, not only in its basic decision in the Lawrence v. Texas case, having to do with the sodomy law in Texas, but in citing a case outside of U.S. jurisdiction. They appealed to the European Court of Human Rights and to its view of sodomy laws. And Scalia says, that's not good. That's not good. It's open lines when we come back. I'll share that with you. Our phone number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And we'll get another perspective from the Spectator, American Spectator. Happy Federer says, if you give a mouse a cookie, well, gay marriage is coming. We'll be right back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. However, we are not funded by the church body. We're also not affiliated with Lutheran Hour Ministries or the Lutheran Layman's League. Issues Etc. is supported by listeners like you. Please help support this worldwide outreach by making a gift this week. Our address, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Thanks for your prayerful consideration.
Wouldn't it be great if we went through life without any problems? Well, that's just not the way things are. Life can get tough, but we can face whatever comes along with peace and confidence because there is reason for hope. We're your neighbors, the people of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and we'd like you to know that with Christ, there's plenty of hope to go around.
a message from your friends at Issues, etc.
Creationists, unfit to be doctors?
Answers with Ken Ham, president of the Bible-Holding Ministry of Answers in Genesis. Now, Ken, that's a pretty ugly thing to say about Christians who believe what the Bible says about creation. Well, who said it and why?
Actually, a college professor said it, and his school, Texas Tech University, supports him. On the school's website, he says that he won't give letters of recommendation to any students entering medical school unless they first believe humans evolved from other life forms. He believes that, since evolution is the central unifying principle of biology, end of quote, how can someone who rejects evolution make a good doctor? Well, this professor is guilty of the very things he accuses creationists of doing. He says creationists commit malpractice because good scientists would never throw out data that don't conform to their expectations or beliefs. Yet he later writes about, quote, the fact of human evolution, even if all the details are not yet known, end of quote. But my good friend Dr. Carl Whelan was once a practicing doctor, and he's repeatedly debunked the claim that doctors must believe in evolution. Not one medical discovery depends on evolution. The truth is, there are many examples that illustrate the fact that belief in evolution has actually hampered medical advances.
In the last few years, perhaps the most asked question we've received at the Answers Ministry is this: where did Cain find his wife? If you've ever wondered yourself, the answer can be found on our website, AnswersRadio.com. AnswersRadio.com.
Open Lines rounds out today's Issues Etc. program. Next, for your questions and your comments, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. AM 850 KFUO weather for St. Louis. Overnight showers and thunderstorms are likely. Low of about 70 for Thursday. Partly cloudy, a bit cooler. High near 86 tomorrow. Right now, scattered clouds, and it's 93 in St. Louis. Another look at St. Louis traffic. Southbound 170 between Del Mar and 40, slow traffic there. Southbound 270 between Page and Doherty Ferry, some stop-and-go traffic. Eastbound 40 between Chesterfield Parkway and Woods Mill Road, some slow traffic there. Northbound 55 between 44 and the Poplar Street Bridge, slow traffic in the right lane. And eastbound 40 between Compton and the Poplar Street Bridge, slow traffic there. That's traffic and weather on AM 850 KFUO.
Whining, food tantrums, bedwetting. Next time on Focus on the Family, psychologist Dr. James Dobson counsels parents of toddlers. Those moms and dads coping with their children's unlimited energy and rapid development. It's timely tips, it's reassurance, and it's practical assistance. Coming next time on Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., the Elks, not the animals, but the lodge, the group. Dr. Alvin Schmidt of Illinois College joins us tomorrow to talk about that, a story from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. They will be having their convention here, the Elks, and they're pondering shrinking membership. We'll find out who the Elks are tomorrow on the program. Also, Dr. Ron Feuerhahn on The Cost of Discipleship, a book widely disseminated and read. Its author, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, is not available because he's been dead for 60 years. We will be talking with Dr. Ron Feuerhahn about that book tomorrow on the program, and Mall Christianity with Dr. Gillis Harp of Touchstone Magazine tomorrow on Issues Etc. The last 25 minutes of the program are open lines for your questions and your comments. So much to do, so little time. Here is a story. This is an update on a story we've been following. This is from the Dallas Morning News, by the way, but you could have found it just about any national newspaper. Arizona bishop pleads not guilty. Remember the story we brought to you about the Arizona bishop, Bishop Thomas O'Brien, who first made headlines because he had a major portion of his authority taken from him by a local prosecutor because of the way that he had handled sexual abuse scandals within his diocese. He was allowed to remain on. It was actually an agreement that was struck so that he would not be indicted for crimes. The agreement was, I will let a state-appointed entity, agency, take over all the investigation of the sexual abuse in my diocese. I won't even touch it anymore, neither will my staff, but I will remain as bishop. It was an unprecedented move. And it wasn't 2 weeks after that was a story, then he was back in the news having been arrested for hit and run. Here's the rest of the story. Bishop Thomas O'Brien, former head of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Phoenix, pleaded not guilty Monday to a felony charge in a fatal hit-and-run accident. Bishop O'Brien faces charges of leaving the scene of a June 14th accident that killed pedestrian Jim Reed. Bishop O'Brien, who resigned 2 days after his arrest, told the police he didn't realize that he had struck a person. He didn't comment during or after his arraignment in Maricopa County Superior Court, except to tell the judge yes in response to a question about whether he had seen the charge prosecutors had filed against him. Wearing his cleric's collar and a large silver cross, Bishop O'Brien was escorted into the courtroom through a black back door flanked by at least three attorneys. "He's doing as well as he can under the conditions," said Vicar General Dale Fushek after the hearing. "There's a lot of pressure on him." Now, the prosecutors have said that Bishop O'Brien was not impaired by alcohol at the time of the crash. He wasn't driving drunk. The pedestrian that he struck, however, was way drunk. He was twice the legal limit in Arizona. Prosecutors also said, had the bishop simply stopped shortly after the accident, had he stopped at any time after the accident, he probably would not have been charged. As it is, he will be facing a felony charge in this hit and run. He's pleading not guilty. Just a little update for you as we begin open lines in the last 25 minutes of Issues Etc. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I've seen more ink spilled on the ins and outs of the Supreme Court decision, Lawrence v. Texas, than just about any Supreme Court decision in recent memory. They all make headlines and they're all big news, but this one has been taken apart and put back together in the press many times. One of the things, in fact, I asked Dr. John Warwick Montgomery about this when we had talked about the decision right after it came out. One of the things that is being questioned by one of the justices himself. The dissenting justice, not the only one, but one of the dissenting justices, Antonin Scalia, in USA Today, is cited as saying there's a problem with the majority decision in Lawrence, and it has to do with what law is being cited. Normally, if you've ever read a Supreme Court decision, it is proper form to for the Supreme Court to cite itself all the time, to reference itself, to say, we decided this back in so-and-so v. so-and-so, or a previous court decided this back in so-and-so v. so-and-so. That is how these decisions are taken. They're taken by looking at precedent, and that's how these decisions are argued and how they're presented. There was an interesting thing that stood out in the majority decision in Lawrence. Here's the story from USA Today. The Supreme Court's reference to a foreign law in a ruling last month that overturned state anti-sodomy statutes stood out as if it were in bold print and capital letters. I noticed it when I read it. Writing for the majority in a landmark decision supporting gay civil rights, Justice Anthony Kennedy noted that the European Court of Human Rights and other foreign courts have affirmed, quote, the rights of homosexual adults to engage in intimate consensual conduct. Never before had the Supreme Court's majority cited a foreign legal precedent in such a big case. Kennedy's opinion in Lawrence v. Texas, which was signed by four other justices, has ignited a debate among analysts over whether it was a signal that the justices will adopt foreign courts' views of individual liberties. Now, this is an important point, and I think people are free to disagree on this. Should the Supreme Court of the land, let's just make it general, should a Supreme Court in any sovereign nation feel free to cite court cases of other nations in support of their decisions? Now, it's certainly unprecedented. There's no two ways about that. Although I would imagine that it's not unusual for courts outside the United States to cite Supreme Court decisions within the United States. I might be wrong, but it just seems to me that it's probably not unusual, given the fact that, say, the basic declarations of human rights that are adopted by world court and things like that bear a striking resemblance to the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution, the Bill of Rights. In theory, the fact that Kennedy cited the European Court of Human Rights and others' affirmations of homosexual adults' right to engage in intimate consensual conduct, in theory, that could mean that the currently conservative court someday might be influenced by other countries' opposition to, say, the death penalty, their emphasis on foreign prisoners' rights, and even their acceptance of same-sex marriages. For instance, here's a good example. Canada is well on its way to getting same-sex marriage. We talked about this earlier today. It has been a Supreme Court decision in one of the provinces and now two of the provinces of Canada. Would it be right for the U.S. Supreme Court to say, look, in a case pertaining to same-sex marriage and whether or not it is a constitutional thing, let's look at what the Canadian courts decided. But this is far from clear that the U.S. High Court routinely will turn to foreign law, and the practice does have its critics, notably Justice Antonin Scalia, one of the dissenters. When the court interprets the Constitution, he has written, U.S. attitudes about what is decent and right, not foreign ones, are what should matter. In Lawrence v. Texas, the court relied most fundamentally on the U.S. Constitution's right to privacy to strike down laws prohibiting oral and anal sex. I'm sorry to have to say it, but that's what it says, between consenting adults of the same sex. But it also emphasized the values we share with a wider civilization and how privacy for gay men and lesbians has been accepted as an integral part of human freedom in many other countries. It surprised me to see it in a majority opinion, because there has been debate among justices over whether foreign law is relevant to rulings on U.S. law, says Yale law professor Drew Days, a former U.S. Solicitor General. Days is among those who saw the reference as a step forward. What about you? Do you see this as a step forward or a step in the wrong direction? That the U.S. Supreme Court would cite other courts outside the United States in support of a majority decision. You know, I can see advantages and disadvantages to this. I really can. The disadvantage would be, someone might say, well, it threatens U.S. sovereignty. And I don't know if that's true, because it's still the Supreme Court that's making up its mind. We do not know, really, what influences the minds of these justices. I mean, they might be influenced by what they saw on Ren and Stimpy last night. They just don't put it in their in their decision. They might be influenced by what their wife or their brother-in-law thinks about these things. They just don't cite them in the decision. You see what I mean? It's still the Supreme Court making up its own mind. It's just saying, you know, we're going to look and see what other people think about this, even outside the United States. One of the advantages might be this. Let's say, for instance, just for instance, we have Roe sitting for reconsideration on the docket of a future Supreme Court. Roe is back up, and a future Supreme Court is going to take a good hard look at it and say, is it a constitutional decision? There's a real possibility that they might overturn Roe. All right, isn't this the pro-lifer's dream? It is. It is mine. All right. What if in the majority decision to overturn Roe, that court said, look at these other countries that have seen fit to make abortion illegal, or have seen fit to allow abortion. In the case of overturning Roe, it would simply send abortion back to the states for the individual states to make up their mind. See these other countries that have made it a part of their provinces' decisions, not their federal government's decisions. What if the U.S. Supreme Court cited a foreign court or a foreign decision as part of its support for overturning Roe? Would you complain? Would you be concerned about national sovereignty? What if the United States were the only country that still had decriminalized abortion? Wouldn't you think it would be a good argument to say, why are we the only country that's still doing this? Why are we the only country that still kills our babies to the tune of 4,000 a day? Why does, let's just say for the sake of argument, why does England see fit to outlaw this practice, but we don't? You see, you're appealing to an authority outside the boundaries of the United States. I could see, it might be far-fetched, I don't know, but I could see a situation in which you might want the court to consider outside opinions. It's not the sole basis for their decision, but I'll point it out again. We don't know why they really make their decisions. We know why they say they make their decisions, but we don't know what is really behind their decisions. I mean, anyone worth their salt can come up, can make up their mind on an issue and then go find precedent for it in the law and in other court decisions. That's not hard to do. That's what they do every day. Otherwise, we just let a computer decide this thing. We just say, where do the precedents line up? Beep, bop, boop, beep, and there you go. You got your decision. But we let human beings decide these things because we know that human beings have a more complex decision-making process at work than just what has the law said before. Something to think about. It's open lines, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Don't think for a minute that, really, don't think for a minute that we might not come to a situation where the United States, where, say, pro-lifers might be appealing outside the United States because the United States might be the holdout on abortion rights rather than the leader of abortion rights as it presently is. World opinion could change. This is a most amusing column I found in the Weekly Standard. It's by Joe Engel. It's titled, No, We're the Greatest Generation, A Baby Boomer Speaks Out in Defense of His People. Attention, baby boomers. Remember the good old days, how we locked arms and ended the war? Well, the time has come to dust off the placards and rally once more in America's plazas to stop another vicious war based on lies and deceit, one being waged against us personally. You may not have noticed, but it started a few years ago when Tom Brokaw issued his own Gulf of Tonkin resolution, published a book that dubbed our parents the greatest generation. For some reason, the idea took root, and through repetition became accepted as self-evident truth. It's nonsense, of course, since we've taught the world no one is entitled to call something the greatest, thus implying that something else is less great. But knowing that the old folks don't have much longer, we humor them with this fiction, nodding our heads and smiling the way one does when the fat kid finally crosses the finish line. The greatest? Maybe the luckiest. Lucky to be born during Prohibition, lucky to grow up in the Depression, and lucky to fight on Omaha Beach and Iwo Jima. I mean, come on, they got the chance to face down both poverty and evil in the space of 15 years. Oh, that we had the same opportunities. We'd have finished the job in 10. As Bill Clinton, the most famous and most quintessentially boomerish boomer of them all, said wistfully of September 11th, I wish this had happened on my watch. Like our children, who are fortunate enough to have Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden as adversaries, our parents were the beneficiaries of history. They came of age at a time when the world needed to take out the garbage and sweep off the porch, and they did so with a measure of success that doesn't imply an inherited greatness in their collective character any more than a parking ticket makes a meter maid a hero. Never forget that boomers, never let them make you feel inadequate for putting chi in your dorm, on your dorm wall, Che Guevara, by the way, on your dorm wall, instead of Betty Grable in your duffel bag. It's not your fault. In fact, the next time you're forced to watch some old guy raise his pants leg on national television to show off his USS Indianapolis scar, consider what sorts of unworthy enemies we boomers had to measure ourselves against in our youth, the suburbs. a stultifying prison of Eisenhowerian homogeneity intended to subvert our uniqueness and unfairly curb our sense of entitlement. And Vietnam, a supposed bulwark against Eisenhower's dominoes that was as phony as McCarthy's list of communists. You should take pride in knowing that we did better than any other generation could have done with such thin material, first by protesting against it, and then by abandoning both the suburbs and Vietnam as not being in our best interests. Yes, making the personal political required a kind of genius that historians agree no other generation has ever exhibited. It took unprecedented audacity and courage to trash the dean's office, to shut down the university, to set fire to the ROTC building, and then to hand the dean a list of demands that began with no reprisals. But we didn't stop there. Indeed, it took boomers to point out that the truth that which not even veterans of Guadalcanal and the Bulge had the insight to coin, that war is not healthy for children and other living beings. It took us to question authority, though given who our authority figures were, this should be considered a no-brainer rather than a profound accomplishment. It took us to grant power to the people and the addition of the, thus elevating a 100-year-old concept of sublimity by referring only and specifically to the crowds present at anti-war rallies. It took us to realize that nothing on television is unimportant and that anything not on television can't possibly be important, both of which we realize by watching ourselves grow up on television. It took us to abolish horrifics like Mr., which made it okay for our friends to say, "What's up, Bob?" and for us all to feel good about it. It took us to institute the pass-fail in college in order to do away with competition, and then transform kindergarten coloring books into elite preschool admission tests. It took us to free our black brothers and sisters from centuries of injustice and terror, which we did not by marching in Selma or becoming freedom riders, not our fault, we were much too young, but through far more subversive and effective means, by buying hundreds of millions of Motown records. Oh yes, and it took us to bring back the F word into common, unashamed, mixed company usage. This, boomers agree, was our proudest achievement, by the way, because it overturned 5,000 years of recorded tyranny. We clearly recall the early 60s being an assault of cries of golly and swell and keen in the malt shop. We can't forget how radio programmers across America refused to play Jimmy Dean's Big Bad John until he re-recorded its final words to say Big Big Man. Instead of, well, one hell of a man. And we shake our heads at the sad memory of Art Garfunkel recounting for Simon and Garfunkel audience how he and his partner had unwittingly posed for photos against a subway wall on which someone had scribbled the old familiar suggestion. To a boomer, such compulsory euphemisms brought to mind the horrors of medieval France. And so just a few brave and inspired souls before them had fought to hasten the Enlightenment, we too did boomer sacrifice themselves and their high school detention records for the greater good of shouting the F-word over the air, on Broadway stages, in movie theaters, and from across the street. Keeping it real, that was the goal. And with mission accomplished, boomers can all feel satisfied, particularly when they hear 9-year-olds keeping it real at dinner. Stand up for your generation, boomers. We worked hard for our place in history. Having to ride our bikes on the streets and sidewalks unprotected by crash helmets and open aspirin bottles without childproof lids, think back to our salad days, how we marched shoulder to shoulder, fists raised defiantly, our voices chanting in unison, each of us determined to reach our destiny and remake the world in our image. Well, thanks in part to the dean who agreed that there really should be no reprisals, we finally got there. We are the world. We are the children. That's Joel Engel. He signs it Berkeley Class of 73. And as they age, they want us to bring this madness into the church. A generation that lived on the axiom of change for change's sake. They're not finished with the social structure. There's one more field of battle they're ready to conquer. And it's the Christian church. They got all the change they wanted in the culture, and now it's time for a revolution. Change for change's sake. I imagine with the same results, probably. The difference is this. The next generation sees right through it. And the next generation, in one of the most amazing twists, one of the most amazing ironies of history, actually looks back over the shoulders of the boomer to that greatest generation and beyond to previous generations, something the boomers consider completely irrelevant. They look back over the shoulders of the boomers to those other generations. They see something there worth keeping. They realize that their grandfathers and their great-grandfathers weren't idiots. And they didn't live in times so different from ours that we have to completely disregard everything that they said and everything that they wrote and everything that they left us. They realized that things like tradition are far from being the shackles of our parents trying to keep us from being ourselves. They realize that tradition is actually the accumulated wisdom of people who have lived longer than they have lived. I mean, think about it. That's part of what makes Grandpa, Grandpa. He's been around longer than you. Next time you go to Bob Evans and you sit across the aisle from a couple that looks like they're just ready for the nursing home, and they sit there silently just eating their eggs and they're quiet and they don't do much and they pay their bill and they leave and you think, oh, pitiful old people. Remember, the reason they're probably quiet is because they've heard it all and they've said it all. And they can listen to you babble on about your opinions about life. They've heard that too. They probably said that once too. Maybe the reason that they are quiet and complacent and maybe the reason that they stick with the things that are old rather than always run after the things that are new is because they know better. They've learned better. And maybe, rather than chucking them aside and saying, look, you're yesterday's model, Gramps. The church has got to move on. Maybe we should listen to them. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.